Recording. Hi, Mark.
Hey Sean, how you doing?
Good. How's it going?
It's going well, thanks. I'm dealing
So it's
with
been.
problems with my office phone, but apart from that, everything's okay.
Yes, I can hear you more or less. So
That'll do.
anyway, it doesn't really matter. I can just babble on whether or not I hear anything that you're saying or
It will
not.
be no different to usual.
It's a standard blogging heads tradition, actually. I don't want to name names, but there are people who don't really seem to need any other head on the blogging heads. So we did this once before. We blog headed it before. A few weeks ago, we talked about the late universe, and of course, actually, it just occurs to me that we can't get by without mentioning that there have been slight controversies in between now and then. Do
There
I know what I'm
have.
talking about?
I do not, no.
Yes, you do. There was a young Earth creationist on Blogging Heads.
Oh, you mean blogging heads controversies? I thought you were talking about
Exactly.
physics controversies, cosmology controversies.
Yeah, no, that's not as interesting. I don't think there's been any cosmology controversies over the last, what was it, month, so.
I'm relieved to know there wasn't one that I've missed.
So they did have, someone on Science Saturday on Blogging Heads who believes the universe has an age measured in thousands of years rather than billions of years. And so that was a bit of a kerfuffle, and I think that, I don't know for sure, but I think that it was sort of a failed experiment, and hopefully it won't happen again. I mean, it's a tough question. What do you do with people with whom you disagree? And I would argue that it's okay to engage people with whom you disagree, but there's some cutoff of respectability that it just doesn't do any good. And if someone really doesn't believe that the universe is billions of years old, there's kind of no reasoning with them, and it's kind of contrary to the spirit of a blogging head's discussion, even to put them up there. I don't know. What do you think?
I agree with that. I mean, I think there are plenty of things that you can have honest to goodness disagreements with people, and some of those things are scientific issues. It turns out that the age of the Earth is one of those and has been settled. I mean, I think it's like having someone on who, believes in the flat Earth theory or believes in Santa Claus or whatever you like. You would not contemplate having a Blogging Heads TV discussion about any of those things, and I think young Earth creationism firmly belongs in that camp. So I
Of
think
course, I
I'm
bet by the
hoping
end of
what
this
you're
hour we're going
hoping.
to get to things that other people believe are firmly in that camp, but
That's right.
that's but we're here. We have the microphones and the cameras and our
Absolutely.
little laptops,
That's
so
right. My
they
door is
can't
locked.
do anything about it. So speaking of which, I think we thought about the idea of talking about the early universe since we talked about the late universe last time, and I think hopefully we can get to some of the more fun and also interesting and controversial aspects of it. But I guess we agreed to start by talking about the fact that our universe looks weird. Our universe looks unusual to us in some sense, and this fact has driven a great amount of cosmological theorizing, which has really become central to the way that we think about the universe these days. And so what we mean by that is that, we have a universe, we look outside on a dark night with very good telescopes, and we see it's full of galaxies, 100 billion galaxies. They're expanding, and they're also, the galaxy's not expanding, the space between them is growing, the galaxies are moving apart from each other. And it's more or less a smooth distribution of galaxies. They're evenly scattered throughout the universe. They clump together on medium-sized scales, but on very large scales, they're smooth. And furthermore, because it's expanding, in the past, things were closer together, and things were even smoother. So the galaxies didn't exist at very early times. 14 billion years ago is when the Big Bang happened, more or less. And so for a billion years after the Big Bang, there weren't any galaxies. There was more or less just a smooth, featureless cloud of gas and plasma with very, very, very tiny ripples in it that grew in time into galaxies and planets and stars and so forth. And that's a very beautiful, compelling story, and it's backed up by the data, and it's no doubt true. But it raises this question because it's kind of an unusual configuration in which to find the universe. It implies that the early universe, 14 billion years ago, had certain very special and finely tuned features. One of them was the fact that it was really, really smooth. And in fact, you can sort of gussy that up, that statement that it was smooth, into something called the horizon problem. If you look at distant parts of the universe at early times, they were the fact that the universe was smooth means that these distant parts of the universe looked the same. They had the same temperature and the same features and so forth, even though they don't even share a common past. They're so far apart from each other that, according to them, they're all of the things that could have reached them, sent a signal to them from the past, were completely disjoint sets. You look at one point on the sky, and it had a certain past that stretches all the way back to the Big Bang. You have another point on the sky that has a past that stretches all the way back to the Big Bang, but these pasts don't overlap. They don't talk to each other. And yet, somehow, the points are the same. There's same features there, the same temperature, the same physical conditions there going on. So how did they know to be at the same conditions? And that's the horizon problem. There's also something called the flatness problem that the universe has. It could be flat, could be positively curved, it could be negatively curved. And if there's just a little bit of curvature at early times, that grows as the universe expands. And so you would expect just a tiny bit of curvature to become very noticeable today. But in fact, it's not. Our universe is, as far as we can tell, perfectly flat, the spatial part of our universe, the three dimensions that are expanding. So we have these fine-tuning problems. The early universe is not just what we would guess. It doesn't look like it was randomly selected from any collection of possible configurations. It looks like it was set up very particularly with flat spatial geometry with smooth features stretching throughout it. And this has caused great puzzles, and this has caused a lot of theorizing to go into it. And right now, far and away, the dominant idea for approaching this, resolving these puzzles, is this idea called inflation, which we're going to talk about.
Yep, that's right. I mean, it's worth pointing out that, you know, the reason these things are puzzles, you know, arises from sort of rather mundane treatment of Einstein's theory of general relativity applied to the universe. So, you know, on the largest scales in the universe, the most important thing, in fact, the only thing we think is important, is gravity. And right. Gravity is described by general relativity. And the one thing you always learn, of course, about gravity from very early times is that gravity is an attractive force. It causes things to collapse. It causes things to fall together. It causes things to clump. And so when you look at the universe, you know, what we do is we look at the way it is today. We look at the size of clumps, which, you know, you can think of as galaxies and clusters of galaxies and things like that. And we ask the question, what must that have looked like in the past? And there are sort of two components to that. One is, you know, what can we observe about the universe that's going back? And the other thing is, if you measure what's in the universe today very accurately, and you know how that stuff behaves as you go back in time, then that tells you how the universe itself should have behaved. And in the universe, the two things we know for sure, well, there's more than these two, as we discussed last time, but the two things that we encounter on Earth every day are regular matter, the stuff that we're made of, protons, neutrons, electrons, and radiation, light.
Right.
And so,
matter and radiation, yes?
Absolutely. So if you take those components for the universe and you run the equations of general relativity back in time, as you say, these problems, the question of why is it that, you know, points on the sky that are, say, greater than 7 degrees or so apart, I think is the number, never once in the history of cosmic evolution were in contact with one another. So how come they have this?
1 degree.
Is it just 1 degree?
On the microwave back, I don't know. We can look that up. Someone, we're going to ask now someone in the Blogging Heads audience to look that up and put it in the comment section.
Yeah, actually, 7 is certainly not right, but I thought it was bigger than 1. But anyway, some number of order 1 degree apart, then, you know, you trace them back in time. They never spoke to one another, so how do they know to look approximately the same, to have, to a large degree of accuracy, the same temperature of the microwave background radiation?
And there's a little subtlety there, which I think is worth emphasizing, because people sometimes say, but the Big Bang was a point. Everything was touching everything else. And that's not really right, and this is sort of a technical idea in general relativity, but the Big Bang was really a moment in time when things were infinitely dense, but it was not a point. It was not really like everything was on top of everything else.
That's right. It's a point in time, not a point. It's an event,
singularity,
not a...
which probably wasn't there because singularities aren't real. It's just a signal of our failure to completely understand what the theory is trying to tell us.
Right, right. So we do run these equations back, nevertheless. So it's, as you say, we're running back in time to get closer to the Big Bang, not running, you know, around in space waiting for things to accumulate at a point. And we're led to these rather puzzling facts, as you say. Why was the early universe so smooth, so flat, so featureless? Now, you know, when things like that start to worry you, the first thing that cosmologists do, one of the first things is to ask, well, you know, maybe the stuff that we have in the universe today that's very important, if we ran backwards in time, is not the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other kinds of physics that would enable the universe to naturally become flat, featureless, etc.? And the hard part about that problem is this thing to do with gravity, namely, whatever stuff you think of has energy and mass, and therefore you would normally think, well, then it must cause things to cluster and clump up and become less flat and homogeneous. And the trick of inflation, this idea of inflation, which goes back to the very early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, is that in general relativity, it's not just the amount of mass or energy that's the important quantity that governs how space and time behave. It also is a question of pressure. How is the material, the type of material you have, distributed? And so it became clear at that time that if you could pull a trick off and dominate the early universe by just what's called potential energy, then you could, in fact, get the universe. This would have a tremendous amount of negative pressure. It would push the universe out. And you could overcome this clumping tendency of regular matter and cause the universe to become very, very flat very quickly and also incredibly homogeneous, because what you'd be doing is taking a tiniest, tiniest patch of the early universe over which conditions would be incredibly uniform and blowing it up to many, many sizes. And we can start to give numbers if people would like us to, I suppose, but the numbers are ridiculous very quickly, but many, many times the size of our observable universe today. And so in that picture, all our universe today came from such a small patch that it was causally connected, and that explains why it has much the same features in all directions.
Right, and so we should give some credit to Alan Guth, who was the first guy to work out these ideas in the, like you say, late 70s, early 80s. And in fact, Alan was not trying to do cosmology. That was not really his interest. He was trying
to
solve other problems of other unwanted relics that should have appeared in the early universe. And he realized this idea that if you had a whole bunch of potential energy, which is similar to what we would now call dark energy in the late universe, if you had this sort of super strong form of dark energy at early times, it could take a tiny little patch and smooth it out and blow it up to tremendous size, and you would, in fact, get something that looks like our actual early universe.
That's right. And I think the nice thing about that early work is, you know, Alan Guth wrote down this beautiful paper where he explains the principles of inflation and writes down a model in which you can see the physics at work. But already the model that he wrote down had some problems. Inflation didn't complete properly in that model. It didn't this phase of the universe didn't populate the entire universe properly. And then very quickly afterwards, other people, Paul Steinhardt, Andreas Albrecht, and Andre Linde separately wrote down models which actually seemed to work, period. Which
it was quite
a time in theoretical cosmology in the early 80s when this was all realized within the space of a year or two.
And then soon thereafterwards, there was a bonus. So inflation was a wonderful thing because it explained the apparent fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe, explained why the universe is flat and more or less smooth. But, of course, the universe isn't perfectly smooth. There were small deviations from place to place that grew into galaxies and stars and so forth. And miraculously or not, I think a thing that gave a lot of people the idea that inflation was on the right track is that if you take the basic idea of inflation and add to it the idea of quantum mechanics, that you can never exactly pin down the universe to any one particular state. There's always some uncertainty principle that lets things vary just a little bit. And you plug that idea into the context of these new inflation models, which worked, you predicted that there was going to be, in fact, a set of deviations from perfect smoothness. There's going to be primordial perturbations in the density of the universe that were more or less the same strength at every scale, at every size across the sky. And that kind of prediction for primordial perturbations is exactly what you need to fit the data. We didn't understand the data very well back in 1980, but the more and more we've been looking at it, the more and more it's become clear that the kind of perturbations that the early universe needs to have in order to explain the cosmic microwave background, the distribution of galaxies, etc., is exactly the kind that inflation predicts. And that wasn't even an attempt on the part of the idea of inflation to predict that from the start. So that's the kind of thing that scientists like. When you come up with an idea and it's not that you have to keep fixing the idea to make things work, it's that the idea starts predicting things you didn't even ask it to predict to start from.
That's right. And the role that the observations of this leftover heat from the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background played in this, can't be overemphasized. It's observing the microwave background and the fluctuations in it, which are sort of tracing the little tiny ripples in the matter and the energy and mass distribution at early times, tells us two things, firstly, the type of fluctuations you would have needed at early times are exactly the ones that inflation should give you, as you said. And secondly, as another bonus, precise observations of the microwave background these days, coupled with other measurements like of the Hubble parameter, tell us that the universe is spatially flat. And right. One thing you would think from inflation, I mean, it's true that you could have a universe that was, you know, had been made almost exactly flat by inflation, and then now today curvature had grown and the universe is not quite spatially flat, but you can measure that deviation. But by far the most normal thing to have is that inflation does an awful lot of expanding of the universe. As I said, makes it much, much bigger than our universe, much flatter than you would ever imagine. And even today in cosmic history, curvature just hasn't manifested itself. So a pretty clear prediction is also that the universe should be flat, and we do see that these days.
Yeah, and to make it a little bit more vivid there, you know, inflation made this prediction back in 1981, and observational cosmologists made it their task to actually measure whether there's enough stuff in the universe to account for the purported flatness, and they didn't find it, and they never found it. And, you know, it was a matter of saying, well, we only get a third or a quarter of the matter we need, but there's a lot of uncertainties, there's big error bars, et cetera, et cetera. And that situation only changed by making the error bars and the uncertainties go down. They got more and more precise measurements of the total matter in the universe, but it never changed from being, you know, something between 10% and 30% of what you needed to make the universe flat. And there was even a moment in the sort of mid to late 90s when some inflationary cosmologists lost their nerve and started writing papers about how, well, even with inflation, you could predict a universe with less matter than you needed to make it flat. But then the discovery of dark energy came along in 1998, and the dark energy turns out to be between 70 and 75% of the universe, exactly what you needed to make it flat. So it is the kind of story that scientists like, where, you know, there's some drama there was some worry that it wasn't going to work, but then the hero swoops in at the end and shows that everything fits the theory in a way that we hadn't anticipated.
Yeah, it's a very nice story. It all hangs together very nicely these days, at least at the level of measuring what the universe seems to be made of.
Right.
Knowing what that stuff is, as we talked about last time, is an entirely other kettle of fish.
Well, so I actually, I have a set of, so I think that we did a good job of giving the basics of the conventional wisdom story. I grew up a conventional wisdom believer, but in my dotage, I've become kind of cantankerous and heterodox. And so actually I have some objections and some skepticisms to the conventional inflationary story. So, should I start saying what those are? Do you want to go on a little bit more about how to match inflation with particle physics, which is a tough problem?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very difficult problem to explain sort of just in words, but it is worth saying just a few words about before we get onto it. I mean, I think like any other revolutionary idea, you know, dark matter, dark energy, inflation, whatever, one would have a lot more confidence if one had a very concrete way to fit the physics involved into our current understanding of fundamental physics. In the case of dark matter, like we tried to discuss last time, you know, we have very good candidates from particle theory for dark right. matter particles. So the fact that there's this weird stuff that is causing galaxies to rotate the way they do and lensing distant galaxy clusters, we find that fascinating, but we're very reassured to have in our hand good candidates. In the case of dark energy, as I think we talked about last time, we do not have any such thing, and that's one reason that dark energy is so puzzling. In the case of inflation, we're sort of, I would say, closer to that than we are to the dark matter story. There are certain details.
I mean, I would go further. I think that in the case of dark energy, we do have the cosmological constant. Even, you know, people don't like it, and its number is very weird, but it fits all the data, and it is an idea. Whereas with inflation, we have plenty of things we write down, and none of them is especially compelling. It's still very much up in the air.
I mean, I think it's a matter of taste. I mean, I think that you can write down models in inflation. They may not be particularly compelling, but I don't find the cosmological constant all on its own compelling either for dark energy, given that
fair enough.
The size is so absurdly small. But I think you know, trying to fit inflation into our particle physics model has, you know, has proven to be quite difficult. You can, of course, write down models, and you can make them technically work. As I said, there are some very specific details that are required in inflation to make it work the way it does. And mostly these are what cosmologists would talk about as the flatness of the potential. Namely, we just want the field, the inflation, to be driven mostly by potential energy. So the thing that's driving it can't be evolving rapidly in time or have large spatial gradients in it. It has to be mostly potential energy. That's one thing. But much worse than that, if you want inflation to give you the right fluctuations that seeded all the structure in the universe, and we, as you described very well, we have a lot of reasons to think that that's a good idea, then you have to have very carefully tuned particle physics models. And people have worked hard to construct those models in the context of string theory, in the context of field theory, and there are some interesting ideas. People have come up with ingenious ways to do it, but none of them, as you say, are particularly compelling. So that's really sort of the nutshell story of the problem
there. Yeah, and this is a very well-recognized issue. I mean, there's been, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of papers written trying to come up with models of inflation that work. And it is, you know, it is possible to do it. And the problem is that, maybe to put it in perspective, inflation is supposed to happen at an energy scale which is tremendously higher than any energy scale that we've actually directly observed particle physics phenomena happening here on Earth. I mean, we're pushing energy scales at about 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 times the mass of the proton. And here we're talking about energy scales that are a billion trillion times the mass of the proton. So we're just guessing. I mean, we have the rules of quantum field theory to go by, but we have no direct empirical evidence of what physics was like at those energy scales. So either that means that there should be no surprise that we don't yet know the right answer, or it's a cautionary tale that you know, we shouldn't be too optimistic about finding the right answer quite soon.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree roughly with that. I mean, we do know that quantum field theory should work quite well given the what we know about the energies and densities of the early universe back to a certain time. And we do know the general relativity should work well when, you know, sourced by those kinds of quantum fields at a certain time. So I think we have reason to believe that we understand a lot of the sort of general theory well. From my point of view, with something like inflation, the harder part has been understanding what the actual theory is at those times, as opposed to the type of theory, and therefore how, say, the inflaton, the field that should drive inflation, emerges from it. The way we understand inflation right now, the energies involved should be such that we can pretty much understand them using general relativity and quantum field theory. Much harder is to understand why a field of that particular type should be around.
No, that's right. I shouldn't have tried to give any other impression. But I mean, we believe, again, we have no evidence on the basis of experiments, but we believe that we can extrapolate the general formalism of quantum field theory and general relativity back to the point where inflation would have happened. It's, you know, it still is true that inflation involves both gravity and quantum field theory, which is a touchy subject, but
I'm sure we're going to get onto that soon as well.
That framework. It's the specifics that we don't understand, and, you know, a lot of things can happen. If we only knew about physics at an energy scale of 1/1,000th of the mass of the proton, it would be very hard to figure out what protons would be like. So extrapolating many orders of magnitude beyond that, we shouldn't be too surprised if some interesting and unexpected things happened.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But I want to give my contrarian position here.
Yeah, I want to hear you stake out a position. And
yeah, so there's actually two. I mean, so you've brought up the well-recognized skeleton in the inflationary closet, namely that you need to fine-tune a little bit to get the potentials, to get the theories to work, and that may or may not be solvable by some clever mechanism. There's at least two other skeletons, one of which is slightly known, and the other one of which, as far as I can tell, is completely unknown. The slightly known one is this thing that Roger Penrose has been pushing for many, many years, and that is a focal point of the book that I've been writing and is supposed to appear in January about the arrow of time. And here the point is just that even inflation, even though it describes a new kind of thing that can happen in the early universe, it's still perfectly set within more or less conventional physics, general relativity, quantum field theory, like you say. And within that set of conventional physics, there is something called the second law of thermodynamics, that entropy tends to increase. And the way that we understand that in terms of microscopic physics is we say that when things are low entropy, when they're orderly in a casual way of speaking, that means that there's only a very small number of arrangements of the fundamental constituents that, that correspond to that kind of state. So if you have an egg, there's only a small number of ways that you can mess with it without making it look like a scrambled egg. Whereas if it's high entropy, things are all mixed up and it's a lot more generic, and there are many, many more ways to arrange the constituents of the thing to be high entropy than to be low entropy. And these problems we talked about, the flatness problem, the horizon problem, are reflections of the fact that the early universe had a low entropy, that it was very, very special. It was not a generic state. And the early universe and the late universe, the universe we're in now, are not two physically different systems. It's not like the universe evolves into a different kind of thing. They're just two different states of the same system. The same set of possible things the universe could be doing is true today or was true in the early universe. And so one way of looking at the task of understanding the early universe is to say, why was it so special in the entropy sense? Why was it such a finely tuned low entropy condition? And from that point of view, so that's completely innocuous, I think. I mean, that's just a different set of words attached to the ordinary inflationary setting up of the puzzles.
Yes.
But then the difference is that when you say, okay, I'm going to solve that via inflation, I'm going to imagine that there was a tiny patch of universe that was dominated by the potential energy of some field and expanded very, very fast and smoothed everything out. All that is true, granted, at the starting point. That you had a little patch of energy that was very, very smooth and dominated by potential energy, and then if that happened, it would indeed inflate, and the rest of the story would be true. But that little patch that is ready to inflate, dominated by this energy, has an even lower entropy than the universe evolves into, than the early universe with the Big Bang and the hot microwave background and so forth. There are even fewer ways to arrange the fundamental constituents of the universe to make it look like a tiny patch dominated by inflation energy than it is to put the universe in a state that looks like the early ordinary hot Big Bang.
It might
so
be
from
what
this
you're
point
saying...
of view, you've attempted to explain why the early universe is so special by imagining that it started out even more special. And that's not really an explanation at all. You just have pushed the problem back to an earlier time and said, well, what made it like that? And I think that one reason why this is difficult for people to sort of catch on to is because since we're not used to dealing with general relativity in our everyday lives,
right.
tend to think of the early universe and the late universe as different. We think that there are more degrees of freedom in the late universe than in the early universe because it's bigger. There are more things that can happen. But I think that's just not right. I think that's just not taking seriously the lessons of quantum mechanics and general relativity. If you took our universe today and you let it collapse, instead of winding the clock backwards, you just reversed its expansion and let it collapse, it would not undergo the time reversal of the ordinary evolution of the universe from early to late. It would be very, very different. Galaxies would continue to grow and black holes would form and the universe would become lumpier and lumpier. And we would get a tiny little patch of space that didn't look anything like something that was ready to start inflation. So I think that there's that by itself is not an argument against inflation, but it's an argument that inflation doesn't by itself remove the need for a theory of initial conditions. Inflation doesn't say it doesn't matter what happened before inflation because once inflation starts, everything is fine. Inflation says we really desperately need an explanation for why this little patch of space was in the right condition to start inflating in the first place.
So I would agree with that. We should come back to it. I should say, you know, as you know, this is something I've spent some time thinking about. I mean, back sort of a decade ago with Tamna Vashaspati, I put some work into trying to formulate how difficult it is to get inflation to begin in an otherwise uninflating space-time within the context of general relativity without writing down a model. And we showed there was some quite
this
interesting
constraints. You and Tamna Vashaspati, right?
Me and Tamna Vashaspati. But the thing you alluded to that we didn't talk about at all in our paper, which I think is quite different, is the second law of thermodynamics. And the one thing you might want to discuss a little bit for people listening is, you know, normally when people think about the second law of thermodynamics, they think about entropy and they think about stuff. So you've got some particles, and the question is, how can you arrange those particles in such a way that they look the same?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think even anyone who's thought a little bit about entropy, anyone who's learned it in physics classes or heard about it in college, has learned about it that way. But you mentioned general relativity, and when you include gravity, sort of implicit in what you were saying is that we know how to deal with entropy in the presence of gravity, that we understand it. And that's presumably not completely obvious to people because...
completely true, so yes.
Right, absolutely. That's right. And you know, the simplest way to say that, as you well know, is that if you were to take a gas of particles in a room, let's say the room that you're in right now, and stick all of them in one corner, then in regular thermodynamics, no gravity, that you know what will happen. Those particles will spread out, they will fill the room, and they will become the entropy will increase in that way, because there are many more ways for them to spread out and fill the room than to be gathered specially in one corner. In the presence of gravity, of course, they will clump together and form a bound object if they're big and heavy enough, etc.
Right.
And that's entirely at odds with what we normally think of with second law of thermodynamics. So it might be worth you saying a little bit about what we know about entropy in the context of gravity.
Yeah, I think that is a good point. And I should say that, by the way, the person who deserves credit for really emphasizing this for years and years is Roger Penrose, who even before inflation came on the scene was pointing out that the real problem with the early universe was that it was in a special, very low entropy state. I should also say that using the word entropy to describe why the early universe is special and finely tuned is useful, but it's not at all necessary. So even if there are things we don't understand about the relationship between entropy and gravity, which is certainly true, I don't think that in any way calls into question the basic argument that is being made here. It's just saying, well, maybe we shouldn't be sloppy about using that language. But right. The point is that if you believe the ordinary rules of physics, both obeyed by quantum mechanics and by general relativity, so hopefully obeyed by the union of the two in quantum gravity, then there is something called a space of all possible states of your physical system. And there's some way to chunk up that space into different states that look the same macroscopically. We might not know what that is, but if you have a room full of gas, you rearrange the atoms, it looks the same as long as you don't change the density and the pressure from place to place. So the problem with gravity is that we don't know what that space of states is. We don't know how to write down all the possible configurations of a quantum mechanical theory in the presence of gravity in an important way. So the technical ability to calculate the entropy of something is just not there. On the other hand, we do know just from simple and very, very robust thought experiments that there's a lot of ways that the early universe could have been very, very different from what it was, and even more ways that it could have not looked like inflation. So I think the basic argument that inflation requires more fine-tuning than non-inflation to set up the initial conditions is robust and is true. But you're right that there is this tension between our ordinary way of thinking about entropy and what happens in the case of gravity. In fact, this is something that this is where I diverge from what Penrose is saying, because Penrose loves to emphasize the fact that, like you said, in ordinary non-gravitational physics, if you just have gas in a room or you're mixing cream into your coffee or whatever, high entropy means everything is smoothed out. Everything just likes to become as featureless as possible. And when we look at the early universe, we see featureless and smooth. And in fact, the radiation that we get from the early universe is thermal radiation, which is ordinarily associated with being high entropy. So there's that sounds weird. It seems like the early universe is high entropy. And you can read plenty of cosmology books that say the early universe is high entropy. But what they're not doing is taking gravity into account. When you take gravity into account, things change. And in particular, as Penrose likes to say, the universe can become lumpier while its entropy is going up. If you take a proto-galactic cloud and you let it collapse and it turns into a black hole, its entropy goes way up, and we know that for sure because a black hole is one of the few things that we really can calculate the entropy of, even when gravity is important. Stephen Hawking gave us a formula for calculating the entropy of a black hole. So, in fact, in the universe that we observe today with 100 billion galaxies, the total entropy is by far dominated by the black holes at the centers of those galaxies.
Right.
And so Penrose likes to emphasize that when you turn gravity on, high entropy means lumpy, not smooth. But then I like to say that's not the end of the story. If you keep following the history of the universe into the future, it's going to keep expanding. With dark energy, it's going to actually accelerate. Things are going to dilute away. And eventually, those black holes will evaporate. And they're going to just turn into a thin gruel of particles via Hawking radiation. And there'll be no more black holes anymore. And you can actually compare the entropy of that Hawking radiation that the black hole's evaporated into to the entropy of the original black hole, and guess what? The entropy goes up as the black hole evaporates. It's higher entropy for the black hole to be evaporated into radiation than it is for it just to just be sitting there. So really the highest entropy states, I'd like to say, look like empty space, look like there's nothing there. The universe wants to expand and dilute away and thin out, and it's not going to be lumpy at all. It's going to be smooth, but in a very different kind of smooth than the smoothness that we had in the extremely high energy density early universe. So the universe is this weird place that we're still trying to figure out. At early times, it was smooth and extremely dense. At middle times, like today, it's lumpy on small scales and medium dense. In the very far future, it will become smooth again. Everything will smooth away. The black holes will evaporate. And through that procedure, through that sequence going from smooth to lumpy to smooth, the entropy is increasing all along the way. So I don't know what to say about that, except it is part of the puzzle. That is part of what we're trying to explain, why the history of the universe looks like that, just to emphasize that the fact that the early universe was smooth and had thermal radiation and so forth does not mean it was high entropy, unless you're just making the mistake of not including the effects of gravity.
So what am I supposed to think about the entropy of the rest of the space-time? So it's true that we understand the entropy of black holes very mm-hmm. well. And nowadays, you know, increasingly so, given the progress that's been made in understanding the entropy and actually counting the states of black holes within string theory.
Right.
But, you know, the universe is not just black holes, right? Space and time is not just black holes. There's the entire space-time between them that is expanding and changing. How mm-hmm. am I supposed to understand what's happening to the entropy of that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And the short answer is I don't know. The simplest thing to do is to guess that it's not important. If the matter distribution in a dense region is fairly smooth, so that even if the universe is expanding or contracting, there's no sort of local lumpiness or anything like that, mm-hmm. the conventional thing to say is that there's no entropy associated with the background space-time itself. That might be wrong. I mean, that it could be more complicated than that, but I would argue that it doesn't matter for the purposes, for our present purposes. I mean, nobody really thinks that the second law of thermodynamics isn't right.
That's right.
That the second law of thermodynamics didn't work throughout the history of our observable universe. And therefore, if you believe that's true, at earlier times, the entropy was lower. And even with inflation, at earlier times, the entropy was even lower. That's all inflation does.
But there's
so
a legitimate
it's
question.
Just because if you ran the clock backwards, we don't think the universe would smooth itself out. And whether or not we'd actually know how to turn that into a quantitative statement about how much entropy there is, I don't think anyone thinks that most possible states of all the matter in the universe squeezed into a small ball actually look like something very, very smooth and expanding at a fantastic rate.
So I think I agree with where you're taking this, but there is a legitimate question, which is when you say no one thinks the second law of thermodynamics is wrong, I think that's true, but there's really a question by what one means by that, because at late times, if the density is low and curvatures are low and the space-time is expanding out, then it's true that since we know that, you know, for example, in the laboratory, thermodynamics works incredibly well, mm-hmm. that it presumably is a good approximation to say that the normal way of counting things and ignoring, as you said, the possible entropic contribution from space-time itself is a good approximation. At early times, of course, curvatures can be high, and the length scales on which you get to talk about particles, you know, particle physics interactions can be not significantly different to the cosmological horizon size. And so in that case, I'm not sure how to take into account the entropy of space and time with the entropy of particles. I would be willing to buy that it may not be that important at the end of the day, and it certainly, I don't think, changes your argument, but I think it is a big problem that we don't understand that.
Yeah, no, I all I can do is agree. I think that,
I love that.
The thing that everyone agrees on is that the early universe was more and more special at early times. There's no, if that were not true, then there would be some time in the history of our universe with the clock played forward where it was getting more special,
right.
Where it was getting lower in entropy, and the second law was not true, and I don't think that anyone that I know of is actually proposing that happened. So we have this confidence that whatever it was that happened within the realm of the observable universe, the entropy kept going up, even if we don't know what the definition of entropy is, even if we don't know, well, we know the definition of it in this very, very schematic sense given to us by right. Boltzmann, that it tells us the number of states that are macroscopically indistinguishable, but what we don't know is what the states are, what the states look like. And I'm just not at all bothered by that. When Stephen Hawking gave us the formula for the entropy of a black hole, we had no idea what that corresponded to in terms of a space of states and all different possible microscopic configurations of the space-time inside the black hole. We are now, 35 years later, beginning to get a hint of what that is from ideas in string theory and other places. So I think that that will come. But I think the general framework is sufficiently robust that it doesn't really matter to me.
That sounds reasonable.
Yeah. But I do, but of course it does, it matters a lot to other people. And I want to, so let me use this as a segue to getting in some of the controversies that we're arguing about these days that stem from inflation. So my personal starting point for getting there is from the Arrow of Time and the apparently fine-tuned nature of our early universe, but other people get to the same ending place with different journeys. But so my journey is the following. So if we want to understand why our observable universe began in a finely tuned, very, very special, delicately arranged state, and then expanded and cooled and became more and more generic, and the universe became more and more useless, and the entropy increased. Why did that happen? Well, my answer is that it must be because, or at least it's very likely because, the universe that we see, even up to the Big Bang, is not the whole universe that there is. That in fact, the early universe, the Big Bang that we see, is not the beginning of all of space and time, but there was something before the Big Bang. And if that is true, it doesn't answer the question all by itself, why was our early universe so finely tuned, but at least opens up a set of possible answers. We're not observing the whole universe. So the question to be answered is not why our particular Big Bang was so finely tuned, but why in this larger picture where the Big Bang was not the beginning, why are there parts of this larger multiverse that look like our local observable universe? And there's a whole bunch of different proposals for how things could have happened before the Big Bang or how we can fit into some kind of multiverse picture.
Yeah. So, I mean, I see the point you're making, and that makes a lot of sense to me. It's true that if you just have the observable universe, that's everything, then the entire question of things like the Arrow of Time and the problems you pointed out with initial conditions is just a question of initial conditions. Right. And those lie outside of the dynamical laws that we have, and you just have to tell those equations what to start with. And that's not a particularly satisfactory explanation for why is the entropy of the universe low, high at early times, because the answer then seems to be because you told it to be high at early times.
We should say it might be the correct answer, but like you say, it would be unsatisfying, so tentatively, we're taking it as a clue that there could be something else.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's certainly the way in which most people have progressed, you know, myself included, for the last, you know, 15 years or 20, 30 years, that's what you're looking for. You know, we have these equations for our universe, and we're looking for a theory of initial conditions. Something that
I
will
think
tell
that,
us.
So, there's a big problem that's raised by this, and it became more acute when people discovered the cosmological constant in 1998, if it is a cosmological constant. And that this is the Boltzmann brain problem, which we can't in good conscience go without talking about a little bit here.
I'm sure people are waiting for it.
So just to set it up very briefly, if you have a universe where there is energy in empty space, where empty space itself might be empty, there might be no particles there, nothing you can touch or feel or move, but nevertheless there's energy. That's just the idea of the cosmological constant. That goes back to Einstein, and it is the best, simplest possible fit to what we see today. And it's more or less similar to the idea of inflation. Inflation is a dynamical field. It's not exactly a cosmological constant, but at least temporarily it acts like a cosmological constant. And like we said, in the presence of this energy, there are fluctuations. There are quantum fluctuations, and those quantum fluctuations purportedly give rise to the differences in density from place to place that we observe now as fluctuations in the microwave background, or they grow into galaxies and so forth. But then people begin to take this idea seriously, namely that if we have a cosmological constant now, it will last forever. It doesn't go away. So we have a 14 billion year old past, but we have an infinitely long future in front of us in this straightforward interpretation of the model that we understand fits the universe. And if that's true, and so we have an infinitely long future ahead of us, and in that future there is energy in empty space, and because there's energy in empty space, there are quantum fluctuations of all the different degrees of freedom that make up the standard model of particle physics, then occasionally there will be quite large and dramatic quantum fluctuations. You could make not just an atom or a tiny black hole appear out of thin air, basically, but you could make a person or a planet or a galaxy. And you might say, well, that's very, very unlikely to fluctuate randomly into a galaxy or a person. And it's true, it's extremely unlikely. But you take the very tiny number, which is the probability per year that it happens, and you multiply by an infinite number of years, and the answer is just going to happen an infinite number of times far into the future. And then, likewise, people go backwards to inflation, and they realize that in a lot of models of inflation, inflation doesn't end throughout the universe everywhere. Some places it keeps on going. It's the idea of eternal inflation. It might have ended in our recent past, our local past, but somewhere else in the universe, inflation is still going on at a high rate of speed. And those regions of inflating universe have quantum fluctuations, and the same story is told. So if you run the numbers, the claim is that in this large multiverse where things are either inflating at a tremendous rate in some places or expanding very gently in regions like the future of our universe, but nevertheless expanding and accelerating under the influence of vacuum energy or the cosmological constant, in this large ensemble, the overwhelming majority of people like you and me, of intelligent observers capable of having a blogging heads discussion, will not find themselves in the warm, comforting confines of a universe with 100 billion galaxies and 100 billion stars per galaxy, et cetera, et cetera. They will be freak observers that just fluctuated out of the thermal mess around them. And there's an infinite number of things like that, and if you, in many ways of counting anyway, there's more of them than there are of us. We're the ordinary observers. We think we have a past with a Big Bang and the galaxies and so forth, and you know, we were born a few years ago. And there are people just like me, according to this line of thinking, that are out there that have the same memories that I do, the same, they look the same, and whatever conditions you want to put on them, but surrounded by nothing but emptiness, but empty space. And this is an idea that makes a lot of people unhappy and leads them to believe that perhaps we don't fully understand what is going on.
Yeah, so, you know, I haven't spent a gigantic amount of time thinking about Boltzmann brains. In fact, probably the most amount of thinking about Boltzmann brains I've done is reading drafts of your book. But I...
Which everyone can buy on Amazon, by the way. I didn't know if I mentioned
that. We'll get to the plug at the end, don't worry. But...
there'll be a link.
I'm sure. But the thing that always confuses me about this, everything you said sounded completely reasonable to me, actually. Crazy, but reasonable, if you get my point.
Yep, I mean, I get it. I mean, well, I should say, just to emphasize, this is how it works. We have an idea like inflation, like vacuum energy, like quantum fluctuations, and we're beholden as scientists to take the implications of these ideas seriously. It's not that we sit around and go, wouldn't it be cool if there were a lot of fluctuating Boltzmann brains? It's that we sit around and go, okay, we have inflation, we have quantum mechanics, we have vacuum energy, what are the implications? And we get as an implication, as a prediction of this theory, that there's a lot of random freak observers out there somewhere in the multiverse.
That's right. So I have one very specific question that I've been sort of hoping to ask you that I'm still quite confused about when it comes to Boltzmann brains. So everything you said sounded reasonable. You're just taking quantum mechanics, thermodynamics, general relativity, let the universe expand, let it expand forever. This is what will happen. And that sounded okay. But then there's a point where I think many people say, and that's ridiculous. And so something must be wrong. So my question really is, what is so wrong with that? I mean, what is there about the universe? I mean, I right now could be a fluctuation. Everything about the experience I'm having right now could be a fluctuation. And in many ways, that segment of time is identical to the life that the experience that a normal observer would have for that same period. Why is that weird?
Right. This is a very good question. I think it's a perfectly reasonable one. I think there's sort of two levels of skepticism. So, of course, you've already happily leapt the first barrier that many people are skeptical about, which is just the claim that within this multiverse ensemble, there could be a huge number of random thermodynamically freak observers, that there's more of them than there are of us. So let's just grant that, and what you're asking is, so what? So how do I know that I'm not one of them, actually,
yes.
Right? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm asking. I mean, not only how do I know, but what is there about our universe that for a moment makes us think that that's not the case?
Okay, so I need to get a really, really good answer to this question. And my favorite answer is evolving with time. But right now it comes in two parts, because there's basically two levels of skepticism that we could have. I mean, in some sense, this is an ancient argument, right? This is going back to Descartes. How do we know that we're not, you know, all of our memories are not, you know, implanted by an evil demon? How do we know we really exist?
Right.
And in these days, it happens in the form of things like the simulation argument that Nick Bostrom likes to push. How do
yes.
we know that we're not just part of some simulation, that we're not in the Matrix and someone else is running us as a computer program? So I think there's two answers to this, because happily, the good news is that this particular proposal of Boltzmann brains, which is the idea given to this idea that a brain of a conscious observer can just fluctuate out of random thermal motions, just as if we waited long enough, all the air in a room
right.
could fluctuate to one corner of the room. The nice thing about that, when you compare it to Descartes or to the simulation argument or anything like that, is that the rules are pretty clear.
Yes.
We know the likelihood. We know the different probabilities that different things would happen. So I think we have a better chance of understanding this context for this kind of argument than we do for the simulation argument or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two answers. One is that if you really take this setup seriously, if you really say, okay, there's going to be more in this scenario, and I'm not saying this is necessary in any scenario, that's the point. The usual point of this argument, which I think that we need to give, the usual point of this argument is that therefore the multiverse can't be like that, right? I mean, no one is actually advocating the fact that this is how we came about. Most people are using it as a reductio ad absurdum to say that this
that's
is
right.
not what the universe must be like on large scales. All right, that was a parenthesis. So how do we know that it's not? And the argument would be, number one, that if it were true that most people with exactly my memories and impressions, the mental state of my brain and the environment around me, where I can define the environment around me in any way I like, it could be the room, it could be the earth, it could be the galaxy, but this scenario makes a very strong prediction that as soon as I look at some part of the universe that I've not yet looked at, something that's outside my immediate environment, it should be in thermal equilibrium. It should be not organized and something that would have arisen as a very natural progression from a low entropy early state through an increasingly complex set of evolutions to the medium entropy current state. It should be what it should, it's the highest entropy configuration of its constituents. It should be very, very cold thermal gas. And so every time I walk outside and I see a part of the universe that is not in thermal equilibrium, that would count as evidence against the idea that I'm a Boltzmann brain. So that's one part of the argument. But then you could be the super skeptic and you could say, well, that is true. The overwhelming majority of Boltzmann brains that looked outside would see thermal equilibrium. But still, some of them won't. There's some chance that some of those brains with exactly my memories will look outside and see exactly Los Angeles out here outside the window. And by this counting, by this argument, there's still a lot more of them than there are the observers that really do live in Los Angeles on Earth 4.5 billion years old, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And so there, I think you have to go beyond a scientific argument to a philosophical argument. You have to be able to say it is true that it could be the case that everything that I experience and everything that I remember just fluctuated out randomly. And in terms of simply collecting data that contradicts that hypothesis, I can never do it. Because any data I can collect, I can say, well, that data could have just randomly fluctuated
right.
out of the surrounding the craziness. But the problem with that is, as David Albert, who I previously had blogging heads with, likes to put it, it's not cognitively stable. It's not a sensible way to think about the universe. Because if that's true, if it is true that everything around us just fluctuated, then all of our reasoning that we use to predict that everything around us just fluctuated, et cetera, is based on lies, mm-hmm. right? It's, you know, all of the laws of physics that we think we know because of experiments aren't actually because real experiments were right. done. It just fluctuated out of the surrounding thermal equilibrium. We would have no right in that scenario to believe any of the logical deductions that led us to conclude this particular conclusion. Whereas if we assume that our sense data and our reconstructions of the past are more or less reliable, then we at least arrive at a consistent, internally coherent point of view about the universe. So I don't think that it is true that there's any data or any logical reasoning that you can give me that would absolutely show that I'm not either a thermal fluctuation or a simulation in someone's computer or being tormented by an evil demon. But I think that it's not consistent to believe any of those things and try to make sense of the world around us, and therefore the sensible, pragmatic thing to do in this circumstance is to actually believe that the basic reconstruction I have of the past and so forth is more or less reliable.
I perfectly buy the sort of pragmatic argument there. I think I often hear it stated, I think, far more strongly than that, in fact, as sort of a scientific rejection of that possibility, and I just don't see how it could be done. You did raise one point that made me sort of smile, which is that, you know, as you say, all the reasoning and all the data we used would be, of course, fake, which, you know, there must therefore, if Boltzmann brains exist people like us with full knowledge of something called quantum field theory and full knowledge of what the quantum field theory of the standard model would be, but for whom frustratingly every collider ever built has given data that is completely inconsistent with it.
Yeah, that's right, and that's also true in things like the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. This is something that people use to argue against the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. They say that if you have an interpretation of quantum mechanics that says that every possible outcome of every event actually happens to some branch of the wave function, then you're going to get some branches of the wave function where everything happens in the sort of the least likely way, right? And there'll be people there'll be real, you know, human beings existing in these branches of the wave function that see all the predictions of quantum mechanics give you these absolutely crazy results. And they would never be able to actually get quantum mechanics right, et cetera, et cetera. I really just don't know what to say about that, except yes, that would happen. And that's just life in a probabilistic universe that you could get really, really, really unlucky. And the good news is that most people don't get unlucky like that. Most branches of the wave function see things happen more or less standardly. And, you know, I'm not at all confident or I don't claim to have figured all that out, but I think that these are the murky waters into which you necessarily move when you're multiplying incredibly, incredibly tiny probabilities by incredibly, incredibly large numbers of instances. But I'm not sure what to do about that.
Right. Yeah. I know what you're saying. I agree with that. I have the question of Boltzmann brains. So if we were to say then, therefore, that just as a sort of working hypothesis, or if you like, as the pragmatic way of moving forward, that obviously a theory that predicts Boltzmann brains and therefore the vast, vast majority of observers like us are just thermal fluctuations is clearly wrong. How does one fix a theory like that?
How does one what?
Fix a theory like
fix
that.
Fix it, yeah. Well, okay, so good. I think that that's the right thing to do. I think that you know, part of the disreputability of the Boltzmann brain argument has been that people somehow get the idea that cosmologists are suggesting we really are these thermal fluctuations, which is exactly the opposite of the truth. The truth is that this is an argument purportedly based on experience, the fact that we look outside and don't see thermal equilibrium, that says that therefore models which predict that most people are these freak fluctuations can't be right. Mm-hmm. So the task then is to take the things that we like inflation, like the fact that the universe is accelerating and could possibly be an eternally existing cosmological constant, mm-hmm. and reconcile them with the fact that we are in this rich, low entropy condition with 100 billion galaxies and so forth. So that's a hard problem, and I'm not going to say that anyone has the right answer to it on the table yet. And part of it is just because there's a counting problem where it's very possible that in a typical, relatively sensible version of the multiverse, there's an infinite number of ordinary observers in happy, thermodynamically sensible environments like ours, And there are also an infinite number of freak Boltzmann brains out there fluctuating out of nothingness. Mm. And how do you say which is the bigger infinity? How do you say which are more observers in the ordinary environments or just the empty freak environments? Right. And I have no idea how to do that. People are trying very hard to do that. It's something that will have to be done if we're supposed to make sense of this. We're not there yet. People are trying. There are some people who think that they have the right answer to that problem, but I don't claim to have that quite at hand yet.
It is worth saying that this thing that you just mentioned, the eternal nature of inflation, which we've mentioned twice now, is something that has breathed a lot of fire into these kind of arguments. I mean, as you mentioned, many of discussions like this were philosophical historically in nature.
Right.
But the idea that inflation is eternal and that therefore the universe is constantly, if you like, spitting out copies of some kind of universe, some of which look like ours, and is doing that, you know, in many places eternally, provides you with a very concrete physical mechanism to realize this multiverse idea. And it's for that reason that I think we're compelled to at least think about it in a somewhat serious way.
Yeah, and I try to emphasize that in the book and elsewhere, the idea that a lot of people object to the multiverse because we can't see any of these other universes. It's not the existence of other regions of the universe is not a falsifiable idea. And I think that that is a true statement, but it's not the right statement to dwell on, because the thing that you falsify in science is not a prediction, but a theory, right?
Right.
And the multiverse, like you say, it is not like a bunch of people are sitting around going, wouldn't it be cool if there were like lots of different universes? That would be awesome. It's like we try to explain something we observe about our universe. It's spatially flat and it's more or less homogeneous.
Right.
We're drawn to invent a theory called inflation. We're trying to explain the acceleration that we observe today. We're drawn to invent the cosmological constant. And then these theories make other predictions. These theories that fit data that we have right now make other predictions, and it's our task, our job, to deal with those predictions.
Yeah, that's
right. So I think that, with the Boltzmann brains, it's just our responsibility to take seriously the implications of the theories that we like for other reasons.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. I certainly agree with that strategy. I mean, if you have a theory that gives you remarkable agreement with many, many, many things, then if it makes some other predictions, no matter how strange and otherworldly they may be, you're forced to take them seriously.
I think we're running low on time, but I want to emphasize one last thing is that many people who talk about the multiverse and the fact that in different parts of the universe, not only can they be far away, but that the different laws of physics that you would locally observe in that region could be very different. You could have a different vacuum energy, different mass of the electron, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
These are all part and parcel of a larger story that the multiverse is not only driven by inflation, but has different compactifications of string theory in different regions of the universe.
That's
and
right.
so forth. And the usual use to which this idea is put is to try to explain some fine tunings, not in the configuration of our universe and what the early universe was doing at early times, but in the observed laws of physics, the observed value of the vacuum energy being the obvious example. It's much lower than it should be, but if it were as high as it should be, we wouldn't be here because we'd be blown apart by the acceleration of space around us.
That's right. Another example is, why is the weak force so much weaker than gravity? People have tried to use the same reasons to explain that.
And so I personally am actually really skeptical about that idea. I just don't actually think that that the anthropic principle applied to that scenario is quite powerful enough to explain why the cosmological constant is as low as it is. I'm open-minded about it. It might be true, but I don't think we're there yet. I know that some people think that more or less that's the right answer and it's time to move on. But I think that the problem of the configuration of the universe, why the early universe was in such an apparently finely tuned state, is actually a numerically, quantitatively, a much more dramatic amount of fine tuning. And there I think that something like the multiverse is clearly the best thing we have to offer on the table right now. But it's worth keeping our eyes open and our minds open and trying to come up with something even better.
Well, it's probably a good place to end, because I basically agree with that statement. I mean, I'm also open-minded about the anthropic principle in terms of its ability to explain something like the smallness of the cosmological constant. I'm fully aware that it could easily be used to explain many other things which we've already shown to be different. And so the cosmological constant may go that way, but it's certainly a logical possibility, and I'm open-minded about it, as you say. I'd like to see someone convince me that they know how to predict that within in a controlled calculation in the full theory. But I do agree that it's a much more impressive fine-tuning problem that you pointed out about the early universe. It certainly does seem that the multiverse provides one way to think about that. I don't know how it's going to all pan out. Hopefully by reading your book, people will find out. Say that again?
And if people want to read more about it, I can recommend a very good book to them.
Yeah, you should name that book right now. I'm sure they haven't heard about it before.
It's a book called From Eternity to Here that you can buy right now, even though it's not going to actually appear in stores until the beginning of January. And in fact, I think tomorrow I'm supposed to receive in the mail the final page proofs that I can correct all the witches and bats and stuff like that, and then it'll be a real book.
Very good. Well, I'm sure it's going to do very well. I've read it all, I think, to some degree already, and I enjoyed it, and I'm supposed to know some of this stuff.
Well, I had fun. So hopefully some young person will read the book and get inspired and grow up and become the next great genius scientist who figures it all out. That's more or less the most I can hope for, since I'm already too old to have new creative ideas in science myself, but I have hope for the younger generation.
Somewhere in the multiverse, you've still got a
Somewhere
chance.
In the multiverse it will happen, yes. All right, well, great. Fun. Very good talking to you. Happy blogging, heads, and we'll have to do this again sometime.
Okay, that sounds good. I'd like that. Talk to you soon.
All right, bye.